right, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Before we start, I just want to say thank you to all of you who have listened so far. If you've rated, liked, subscribed, reviewed, etc., or just replied on Twitter saying you enjoy the podcast, reached out, you know, feedback has been great so far. And I've had a lot more listeners than I anticipated. You know, the first four or five episodes were kind of a trial run, but, you know, just based on the feedback so far, I've decided I'm going to keep it going for a little while. So, you know, I'll be posting new episodes on Tuesdays, as I've been doing, at least for the next 2 or 3 months, and then we'll see where we go from there. But yeah, I'm having a blast so far, and people seem to be digging it. People are listening, so I'm going to keep it going. So thank you. And thanks to the guests as well. They've been just wonderful. I have some pretty exciting guests coming up, so I'm excited for you to hear those episodes. And my guest today is Peter Jones. He is a jazz musician. He's a music journalist, and he's also a biographer. He wrote biographies of John Hendricks, Mark Murphy, and most recently, Donald Fagen. Now, I want to give a little background as to how this episode kind of came together. You know, on the Twitter account, I've gotten quite a few offers to do promotional stuff. And, you know, most of the time I turn them down because I kind of wanted to keep the account a promo-free zone. You know, it's just a place where we can just joke around and it's a hangout spot. I don't want it to become inundated with, you know, promo. But every once in a while, there'll be an offer that's kind of so low key or for something that maybe I would have posted about anyway that I'll go ahead and, you know, take up that promotional offer. And yeah, the last summer, the Chicago Review Press, the publishing company that published this Donald Fagen bio, which is called Nightfly, The Life of Steely Dan's Donald Fagen. The Chicago Review Press reached out to me and they said, we'll send you a complimentary copy of the book. All you have to do is post about it once. They sent me the book. I did a post, you know, a picture of it. People seem super excited about it. But, you know, because I'm so inundated with Steely Dan stuff every day, and I've already read so much of the literature on Steely Dan, you know, I kind of just set it aside. It can be overwhelming to be, you know, this involved in the world of Steely Dan every day. So I put the book aside for a rainy day. But when I was prepping to do this podcast, I thought, you know, I should, you know, pick up that Nightfly book. You know, maybe it'll fill in some gaps. And yeah, I picked it up. I started reading it. And wow, this was a roller coaster. I mean, I honestly think this is the most definitive history of the band that exists. And I'm not just saying that because of the promo. I found the entire thing to be an incredibly compelling read. I love the author's approach. Peter, he interjects his opinions throughout. It's not just a dry, you know, recounting of, you know, the usual arc of Steely Dan. You know, he goes off on this, he goes off on Gaucho, for example. He's not a fan of the album. So, you know, I didn't agree with all of the opinions that he interjects, but, you know, you could tell he's been super invested in the Steely Dan universe, you know, for decades, just based on the book. So yeah, I found it incredibly compelling. So, you know, when I was getting ready to do, you know, more episodes of the podcast, I reached out to Peter and asked, you know, I just finished your book. I thought it was great. Do you want to talk about it? You know, because, you know, I wasn't trying to promote the book. I just want to talk about it. Like, I read the book and I was, you know, super engaged with it. I was, you know, it was very stimulating. So yeah, I reached out and he agreed. So without further ado, this is my conversation with the author of Nightfly, The Life of Steely Dan's Donald Fagen. This is Peter Jones. Enjoy. You know, after reading a little bit of your book, I get the sense that you are a fan yourself. Is that an accurate assessment?
Oh, absolutely. And the same would apply to any book of that nature that I'd be writing. You're with these projects for 2 years, and so you'd better be engaged with it and enthusiastic about it, because it's very easy to, you know, when you hit the inevitable setbacks, it's very easy to be disheartened and think of giving the whole thing up. But in this case, it was a project. It was my dream project in a way to be commissioned to write this. So it sustained my interest throughout.
Yeah, I can tell just based on the there's just a lot of information in the book that I feel like someone would have had to have a long-term relationship with the kind of the Steely Dan world. So much detail from the the number of bootleg songs that are mentioned to, just the, session personnel, all the lore, the stories. Yeah, it's coming from a place of someone who, has a deep reverence for the music.
Yeah, I think that it's fair enough. I mean, reverence, I don't know. I don't really do reverence. But certainly admiration and respect and musical appreciation, all those things, which I had, I mean, I've been following them for decades. I'm obviously a great deal older than you. So, I mean, I'm old enough that I remember the albums when they originally came out. So it's been a sort of, obviously there've been periods when I've been less interested and then a period when I've been more interested, but yeah, I've always been keeping an eye on what they've been doing. So a lot of the book is my own experiences, leaving aside all the research, my own kind of background knowledge, which came in very useful. And of course, being a musician myself was a big help too, because my original interest in Steely Dan was the quality of the songwriting. And being in a band myself, when would this have been? Well, I guess probably around about 1977, 78, I started being in bands. And have, as it says at the beginning of the book, I was going through a period of kind of punk enthusiasm, and all those very highly energetic bands of the era of the late 70s. And I had a particular fondness for the Flaming Groovies
Okay.
from San Francisco. And I wanted to write like them. But then I fairly quickly realized that all they were doing was trying to write like the Beatles from the classic Beatles era of about 10 years earlier. And I thought, well, where do you go after that? And that's when I heard Asia, and I suddenly realized I knew nothing about songwriting. At the time, I was already a professional music journalist, so that was like that kind of detonated a bomb in my brain. I just thought there is so much to find out, and then my songwriting partner and I decided there and then, instead of trying to sound like the Flaming Groovies, we were going to try and sound like Steely Dan,
Oh, really?
because it was more of a challenge, more chords, more harmony, more rhythm, more melody, just more of everything.
Just out of curiosity, what was the name of the band? Is it something I would know, or from the late 70s that you were in?
As I said, it was the punk era, so there was a lot of silliness around, a creative silliness. And so our band was called The Dave.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny that you were into Steely Dan from a punk kind of perspective. And you touch on that in the book. I remember there was a section about punk where you talk about how Donald himself kind of drew parallels between the two. He sort of had a grungier appearance, and he had this sort of anti-authority perspective. But it's interesting because I feel like this comes up a lot where people pit Steely Dan against punk, actually, or punks have a very negative view of Steely Dan. There was a whole kind of brouhaha on Twitter recently where Steve Albini, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he's kind of legendary in the world of like underground or alternative punk music here in the States. He kind of was taking aim again at Steely Dan, saying, "I'm the kind," he said, "I'm the kind of punk who will never be a fan of Steely Dan and their approach." What do you make of that?
I'm not saying anything about this man. This is just a general comment. That sort of attitude betrays a lack of musical understanding, but also that someone perhaps hasn't paid full attention to Steely Dan. And exactly as you say, Donald actually was, I think, had a lot in common with the punks, because he was always anti this and anti that, and kind of anti-establishment, and wanted to kind of poke fun at the world and be satirical. And so I think there's a great deal in common. And in fact, when you listen back to some of the noisier of the Steely Dan albums, I think there's a kind of a punk attitude in there. I mean, listen to some of the stuff on the Royal Scam, even, which was obviously the album immediately preceding Asia. That's some really heavy stuff going on in there. Lots of kind of screaming, caterwauling guitar. And the album, their second album, Countdown to Ecstasy, which they made whilst they were kind of in the midst of their first experience of being out on the road, you know, and there's a lot of anger in there. There's a lot of kind of wild guitar pounding that goes on in that album as well. So I think you need a pair of ears, you know, to appreciate there are parallels between Steely Dan and the punk era.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. So just going back to your own personal experience, so, you know, you were influenced by Asia. Did you kind of follow them from there on? Did you, you know, were you excited when Gaucho came out, or, you know, following Donald's solo album, The Nightfly, and then...
Well, when Gauche came out,
yeah.
I was still working as a full-time music journalist in London. And I remember, and this is where we will have to agree to disagree, because
yeah.
I really don't like Gaucho. And I've tried over the years, ever since it's
yeah.
released, I've tried very, very hard to like it. And I just can't. I just don't like it. And think I've put forward my reasons in the book.
Yeah, I picked up on that from reading it, and I did want to ask you about that, because I think, and, you know, correct me if I'm mistaken, but your feeling of why Gaucho doesn't work is because it was too controlled. It didn't feel like there was really a band that was working together. There was just too much kind of maybe division of labor in terms of all the different session musicians that they were bringing in. Was
I
that...
think you can still pursue a vision with multitudes of musicians. I mean, I've worked with a lot of musicians myself in the jazz field, so I don't think is necessarily a limiting factor on the quality of the music. But what I do think is that I mean, I knew I didn't like the album very much, but I wasn't sure what it was about it that I didn't like, apart from a certain coldness that I find in it. But it was only when I started to research the way that it was produced and what else was going on at the time that it became clearer and clearer to me why the album sounds like it does. And you're right. I think you've already said that there was a kind of... what you didn't get the sense of a band in the studio performing and recording those songs. I don't know how it sounds to you, but to me it sounds like a project that's just dead on the slab. The songs could have been produced in a different way, and the album would have been a whole lot better.
And we don't need to get too far down the weeds with going back and forth about, you know, the merits of Gaucho, but there's a great tension, I think, between the songwriting and the sort of sordid world that a lot of these stories inhabit, and the kind of uncomfortably smooth, kind of heightened smoothness of it, I think, to me, gives it a great kind of counterpoint.
You cannot take for granted the idea that you'd be completely misinterpreting their music if you didn't see a massive disjunction between the words and the backing. I mean, yeah, an apparent lightness of heart, and then these desperate lyrics, people who are sad, lonely, addicted to drugs and women and money, and it's an incredibly dislocating experience, I think, to listen to that album. I think they almost took that aspect of it too far.
Okay, I see. So they went too far in that direction for you on Gaucho.
The junction became so great that there's like a massive hole in the middle of it where the heart should be.
Okay. Okay, I see what you're... I mean, yeah, I think Asia is a little bit warmer. I think there's maybe a better balance. Like, there, you know, songs like Peg and Josie are obviously a bit more, you know, easy on the ears than, say, A Glamour Profession or you know, Third World Man or something.
Easier on the emotions too.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite Steely Dan tracks of all time, if not the favorite, is Asia itself, the track Asia, which is one of the vanishingly rare, honest to goodness, from the heart love songs that they
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Gaucho doesn't really have any love songs on it, and you know, per se, but I don't know. I really love, and I'll swear I'll move on. I just love the sort of construction of it, how each song is kind of this little short story, kind of it's painting this broader picture of you know, Los Angeles or America in the late 70s, and there are these little narratives that kind of...
In the book, I draw parallels between the world of Gaucho,
yeah,
and the sort of neo-noir movies of the 70s.
Yeah, that's a good comparison, I think.
But where, you know, the sun is shining. If you think of well, I think two of the best neo-noir films of that era, first of all, The Long Goodbye, and then Chinatown. These are films that look completely different to the original noirs of the 1940s and 50s, which were kind of black and white, very often shot at night with long shadows. It's very often raining. By the time you get to the 70s, the films are in color. It's California, you know, it's sunshine. It's all kind of, it looks on the surface very kind of radiant and what's not to like. But there's still the same degree of kind of rottenness and double dealing and corruption, that kind of stuff that we get throughout the noir canon, you know, whether ancient or modern. So for me, Gaucho goes right along there with those noir movies.
I think on another one of these, I actually talked about, you know, the person that I was talking to was a big film fan, and we were kind of talking about what are the Steely Dan movies. And I think Long Goodbye was one. I think Long Goodbye and I think Altman in general was kind of his closest analog. I see, in terms of their approach, I think Kubrick would be an interesting analog in terms of the way they, you know, dealt with the musicians. And I feel like one thing that your book does not do is shy away from some of the, you know, your book is not a hagiography. You know, you don't shy away from some of the thornier details of, you know, their process and how the musicians were treated, and just, do you think that you try to take a kind of even-handed view of him?
Very much so, yes. I mean, before the Fagin book, I had written two biographies of jazz singers. The first one was about Mark Murphy, and the second one was about John Hendricks. My commissioning editor for the Mark Murphy book, he said to me, "Oh, by the way, Peter, make it warts and all." I don't know if that's an expression that's known in America, but because it's a quotation from Oliver Cromwell, who was having his portrait painted, and the painter said, "You know, how do you want me to approach this?" And he said, "Well, I want you to depict me warts and all," because he had a warty face. So I was told to take that kind of approach with Mark Murphy. In other words, not hold back, not try and paint a pretty picture, but to do my best to tell the truth about the man and his life. So I've really just continued that ever since with both of the other books. But I have always tried to approach the subject with a completely open mind. And that meant that I would be guided by the research and the evidence that I came up with, you know, starting with a blank sheet of paper. Let's find out about this person. Let's not have preconceptions. So if people say, well, Donald doesn't come across as a particularly warm or appealing character, for example, as some people have said, well, that's because that's what I found in the course of my research. You will be aware that I never had the privilege of meeting him and interviewing him personally because he didn't respond to my requests.
Do you think that affected your approach or no?
You know, in a funny kind of way, I think there are advantages to the fact that I didn't meet him, because I find as soon as I still interview people, you know, for my journalistic assignments. For example, I just did an interview a few days ago with Jose James, the jazz singer. But I find very often if I don't meet people, I can be more objective because I'm not thinking, oh, how is so and so going to react to what I'm saying here.
Did you have that in mind, though, at all? Because, you know, it's quite possible that Donald's still reading the book. You know, did you have it in mind at all? You know, sort of a presence of Donald, you know, maybe because he's, you know, he's still very engaged in some level. I know he's not always the most participatory person, but, you know, I do see him pop up in articles and, you know, he released his own autobiography just a few years ago. So
Donald goes his own way. You know, disappointing though it was, I would still have preferred to interview him. He has hardly ever talked to anybody trying to write a book in the past. I mean, the precursor to my book was one that I'm sure you're very well aware of, by Brian Sweet. Becker and Fagan wouldn't speak to Brian either.
Did you struggle to find information about Donald's life because he's so private, because he's done so few, or?
What you don't get sense of the real human being. If you don't meet them or talk to them, even over Zoom as we're talking now, you don't always get a sort of a rounded view of the person as to the extent that you would if you had met them and spoken to them. On the other hand, my previous two biographies were of people who had already passed away, so I didn't have the pleasure of meeting them either. So it'd be like if I was writing a biography of, I don't know, Harry Truman, or by and large, the people who merit biographies tend to be dead.
So, you know, why did you do it as a Donald Fagan biography and not a kind of Steely Dan biography? Because there are large portions of this book that kind of...
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
Brian Sweet had already written a book about Steely Dan, and I didn't want to just write. I mean, I bow to nobody in my respect for Brian and the work that he did and the incredible research that he managed to do in a sort of pre-internet age, which is amazing. You know, that he interviewed so many people and he unearthed so much information. It was terrific. I didn't want to write a book exactly like that because it had already been done. And in any case, I wanted to put in a lot more context than Brian did. You know, Brian was doing absolute ground level, you know, original research. Nobody had done it before. And so his is the sort of what we call the text, you know.
Exactly.
It's the founding text. So I thought, well, I can build on it. I can do a slightly different book in which I try to look at it more from the point of view of a sort of cultural context. What does Steely Dan mean? How are the songs put together? How do we evaluate this music? So trying to treat Donald more like an artist than simply a guy who lived through a certain period of history. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, and that's exactly kind of what I took because I've read all of the other literature on Steely Dan, more or less. I've read the Brian Sweet, I've read Eminent Hipsters, I've read I mean, there's not a huge amount. There's also Major Dudes. You know, I don't want to compare it up against Brian Sweet's, but you know, one thing that I appreciated about your book is that you do try to provide interpretations to the songs themselves, which. Obviously, there's a lot of ambiguity there in terms of what each song is about, but you kind of, you know, you take a stab at, you know, a lot of them. Are those just your own personal interpretations? Were they kind of a composite of others?
Obviously, you know, as always, you go out there and you look and see what other people have written before you. You can kind of take that as read. But when it comes to interpreting Steely Dan lyrics, I think we're in a, you know, I mean, I could have written a whole book just about that. Never mind the band's history or Donald's
For sure.
history. I actually don't mind the obscurity of their lyrics. I think it, in a way, it makes them more poetic because it gives the listener the opportunity to construct their own interpretation. And who's to say what it's about? Certainly, I've written songs myself, you know, lyrics that I don't even know what they mean.
Well, this came up on Twitter recently. I mean, it's come up repeatedly as I've, you know, been doing this account, but I posted a picture of Rudy's in Manhattan because I just happened to be nearby. And it's a bar and grill that a lot of people have said is, you know, in the inspiration for the line, "I saw you at Rudy's in Black Cow." But someone on Twitter said they interpreted that Rudy's was actually Rudy Van Gelder's studio in New Jersey, where a lot of great jazz was recorded, and that the song was actually about a heroin addict. So that's just one example of,
Yeah,
you
absolutely. And who's to
know.
say which interpretation is correct?
Well, I went back and looked at all the lyrics, and I kind of said, okay, I can see where you're coming from. I had never thought of it that way, but.
Wouldn't it be boring if there was only one way to interpret a song lyric, you know? And this is another area in which Steely Dan score 1,000 miles above just about any other act, in that they were able to construct lyrics which retain their mystery and their sort of multi-layered possibilities of meaning. I really wish more people would write in that poetic style. And there's another part of the book in which I talk about Walter Becker being asked to produce an album by the British band China Crisis. And one of the things that made Walter say yes to this, after being out of music for several years, trying to get himself straight, you know, living in Hawaii and cutting his hair and having nothing to do with music, he kind of inevitably slides back to
Yeah.
music because that's his life, you know, really.
That's what he does. Yeah.
One of the things that he likes about China Crisis is the fact that the meaning of their lyrics is not immediately apparent. And that intrigued him, and that made him
Interesting.
want to work with them because clearly they had ideas that had some parallels with Steely Dan.
Yeah, I'm vaguely familiar with them. I know that album that Walter produced. I haven't dug in as deeply
Beautiful
to the
album.
lyrics. Flaunt the Imperfection, I believe, right?
That's it. And actually, I don't think many people realize that that title relates directly to Steely Dan because perfectionism is what destroyed Steely Dan and what contributed largely to Donald's, I think it's fair to say, breakdown that he had in when was it, 1982? Because he was a perfectionist in a world where perfection isn't possible. And it kind of completely screwed his head up. And Walter goes over to England to produce China Crisis, and he is trying to at first to impose a similar kind of level of detail and discipline on this Liverpool band that he was used to with Steely Dan. And the guys in this band were kind of saying, hey, you know, we did five takes, you know, take four is pretty good. We'll just use that. So they were actually, you know, and Alter would say, you know, he would find things that could be improved. And really the dialogue seems to have been, you know, well, yeah, we know it's not perfect, but we like it. And why not just flaunt the imperfection? You know, why not just celebrate the fact that, yeah, it's flawed, but isn't everything.
Yeah, and I feel like the, you know, the second era of Steely Dan, I guess, if you want to start with the solo albums, it seems to take a little bit of a step back from that obsessive, almost, you know, unhealthy or mentally threatening level of the pursuit of perfection that we saw on The Making of Gaucho. But
I think Gaucho was so extreme in that regard. It would just simply not have been mentally or emotionally possible for them to go through all that again, and they didn't want to. It seems that the production of Nightfly, or The Nightfly,
yeah,
was less problematic in many ways, because Walter wasn't around to kind of muddy the waters, and Donald knew what he wanted, and you know, it was as we all know now, it's another masterpiece, fantastic piece of work. But still, people say, yeah, it's a bit cold, you know. And he, I think Donald's last two solo albums, I don't know whether they're going to be the last two, time will tell, but certainly Morph the Cat and Sunken Condos, I think are excellent. Not least because they're much warmer in tone. They're more human.
I'm evolving at a really astounding rate of speed into something way cooler than what I was before. I feel much stronger than I have in years. My mind is sharp and my spirit's sound. Now people tell me the shape of my face is changing. I've grown an inch taller since July. What in the world is going on? Please tell me. Without you, I now have eyes to see some other destiny. A future scape of bright ideas in which I bring off heroic escapades. I can hold my breath.
So in your kind of research, or, you know, your deep diving as you wrote the book, obviously you had a wealth of knowledge about the, you know, about Steely Dan already and about Donald and Walter, but was there anything new that you discovered? Any surprising pieces of lore, or, you know, anything else sort of that you were, you know, startled to discover?
I think
that...
perhaps the most interesting work was talking about the very early years, the pre-Dan years with Kenny Vance.
Okay.
And for those who don't know Kenny Vance, I think it's fair to say discovered them, Becker and Fagin, because they were fresh out of Bard College. They were trying to write songs. They were trying to get a record deal. They wanted their songs to be recorded by other artists. And nobody was remotely interested, except for Kenny. And Kenny tried for, I think, what was it, 3 or 4 years. To get the music industry interested in what Donald and Walter were doing, and had almost no success at all. I heard a lot from Kenny about those early days, you know, talking about how Becker and Fagin looked like a couple of homeless bums, dressed appallingly. They were incredibly withdrawn. They were a pair of kind of weirdo beatniks who refused to compromise when it came to recording demos. For example, they didn't ever want to do any overdubs at first because, well, Charlie Parker wouldn't do overdubs, so we're not going to do overdubs. This kind of crazy purist attitude.
Do you think that attitude was kind of an almost adolescent immaturity on some level?
Well, I think that's a little unfair when we're talking about mm-hmm. people who are, you know, 20 or 21 years old. Yeah. And, you know, we all have to learn, and they were very young, and they had certain standards that they were trying to maintain. The problems with trying to uphold standards like that is that you basically can't do it, but you need to learn all that stuff, and that was just part of their learning process. But no, the stuff that Kenny told me about that I really didn't know, in answer to your original question,
yeah,
was the presence of these mafiosi,
yeah,
around the office where Kenny and his colleagues worked. Because it turned out that the band that Kenny was a member of, who were called Jay and the Americans, they hadn't had much luck in the charts in recent years. So they were trying to diversify by, you know, starting their own publishing company, occupying an office in the legendary Brill Building. But what I hadn't appreciated was that all this was being financed by some very dodgy characters, including, unbelievably, John Gotti.
Was he really involved?
Well, he was a member. He was a senior member of the Gambino
family.
And those are the people who were around and who basically bankrolled the operation, because they had taken a liking to the lead singer of Jay and the Americans, Jay Black. He was like, you know, hand in glove with them. He used to go and sing at sort of mafia weddings. he was a huge gambler, so he was constantly borrowing money from them to go and gamble. He seemed to have gambled away nearly all of Jay and the Americans' earnings. And there were some very colorful stories, some of which are in the book, about those days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like a Steely Dan song, just the way...
so much, yeah.
That, you know, a sort of over-the-hill 60s band that is, you know, getting bankrolled by the mafia. It's just, it's perfect.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate it. I feel like the sort of earlier Donald years, like up through Bard, a lot of that was like mostly familiar. And then, you know, kind of starting at Can't Buy a Thrill, you know, it was familiar again, but I feel like your book really filled in everything in between. So that kind of like the post-Bard, pre-Steely Dan, those few years, I thought there was like a ton of new detail, you know, a ton of new information that I didn't know about it. So, you know, like from that part on, I was just like really hooked and wanting to, okay, there's going to be a lot of good stuff in here that I didn't know about. So yeah, I thought you really did. You really did give a lot of a new information and filled in a lot of gaps, you know, as someone who, you know, is a big fan.
I managed to, yeah. As well as Kenny, there was one or two other people who were around in those days. And, you know, one of the points of interest was Kenny having spent 4 years desperately trying to help them out and try and get them somewhere, was then cast aside by them. And they, you know, Walter and Donald came out to California and began their career as Steely Dan, and poor old Kenny was left back in New York, you know, without anything to show for it. Although that's not entirely true, as I shall explain in a second. But
okay,
there was the great betrayal, you see, which is that Gary Katz, who in those days called himself Gary Cannon, he hadn't really understood what Donald and Walter were about. And Kenny kept trying to say to him, these guys are amazing. You know, you really need to listen carefully to their songs and what they're doing. And one day in the recording studio, I don't know, I can't remember which project it was, but like maybe just some demos, Gary suddenly said, I get it. Some light bulb had come on above his head, you know, he suddenly understood what they were trying to do. And from that point on, he took a serious interest in them. And when he got a job with ABC Dunhill in Los Angeles, he apparently, because I haven't been able to establish this 100%, but his account is that he would refuse to take the job unless ABC Dunhill also hired Walter and Donald as in-house songwriters. After that, I mean, and they agreed, incidentally. But then there was this kind of subterfuge going on, because the difficulty for Donald, Walter, and Gary was that Kenny Vance owned the publishing to, you know, some really great songs, some of the great early Becca Fagan material. And somehow they had to extract that material so that they could then go and record it in California.
So, especially since a lot of those songs ended up on, you know, later Steely Dan albums, right?
Yeah, I mean, as late as Katie Light, I think some of those very early songs.
Yeah, well, Caves of Altamira on Royal Scam, I believe, was one of the early ones, right?
You're right, that's the album after that. So, yeah, but there was a certain amount of backstabbing that went on. You know, the departure to California was something that Kenny was, nobody told Kenny. And in fact, he called Donald's apartment one day with just some routine matter, only to be told, oh, Donald doesn't live here anymore. He's gone to California, gone with Gary Katz, who up until then had been one of Kenny's closest friends. It was kind of like, you know, Kenny did all the spade work.
Yeah.
And it was Gary who cashed in, you know. I mean, that's a simplification. I wouldn't ever accuse Donald and Walter of being I suppose they were kind of disloyal to Kenny, but it's very understandable. You know, they were frustrated. They've been trying for 4 years to get somewhere, you know, from 1968 to 1972, they were banging their heads against the wall. And finally, there's a glimmer of light, you know, and Gary Katz said, hey, you know, I can get you songwriting jobs in California. Of course they're going to take it. And of course they're going to try and extricate themselves from the contract that they had with Kenny. You know.
One thing that your book also talked about that I'm very interested in is the fact that they were going to tour actually with Asia, right? That they were supposed to tour with Asia and they never did. But I don't think I realized some of the details. Like, they actually sold tickets. Is that right?
I hadn't realized that until I went.
Yeah.
They sold tickets for a tour and it sold out in no time at all.
Wow, I don't think I realized that they even got to that point.
And then they discovered that the musicians they wanted to tour with were not going to be available, or at least not available for the kind of fees that were in any way reasonable.
Yeah.
Because, of course, these are all studio guys like Bernard Purdy, you know, who, you know, if he's going to go out on the road for like 6 weeks, that 6 weeks of session work, very well-paid session work, that he was going to have to forego, and therefore you know, and the same applied to everybody else. So I think it was just decided it was economically non-viable.
Yeah, I doubt they could have gotten Purdy for that necessarily. I mean, it kind of asked the question, you know, the trajectory of the Steely Dan story, how would it have been different if they had actually gone on that tour? I mean, you said that they were maybe going to do a live album and they were doing it as a 45-minute medley. I mean, there were just some interesting
Some very interesting, but then ideas. Again, it all happened actually just with Donald, you know, going out as Steely Dan, as he now does.
Yep.
So it's kind of like it was delayed by several decades, but it did happen.
It did, starting in 93, I guess. Another thing that was new to me, so I know about the second arrangement. It's a huge point of obsession for a lot of Steely Dan fans, as well as some of the other Gaucho outtakes. I mean, I love that you included a whole section about the lost Gaucho, because I don't think I'd seen much about that in other Steely Dan books. But one song that I did not know about is Heartbreak Souvenir.
Right.
Was that song completed? Because I've never seen it. I've never heard of it.
There must be a recording of it somewhere, unless it was destroyed in the infamous Universal fire of, when was it, 2019,
right,
in which an entire warehouse of irreplaceable original studio recordings just went up in flames.
That's tragic. Yeah, I did hear about that. Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the second arrangement, there's always rumors that there's a finished version somewhere, and you know, fans or various people have tried to do their own recreations, and some of them are really good. I mean, you know, some of them are, I think, are, it's certainly listenable, and you get a sense of what that song would have sounded like. But to now introduce yet another, you know, potential, you know, lost Gaucho track is just like, you know, that's another rabbit hole, I guess. That
there are lost tunes from almost every decade, if you want to.
That's true.
I mean, I was interviewing Kenny one time, because I've been pestering him, I said, oh, come on, Kenny, I want to hear some of these tunes that never saw the light of day. And eventually he gave in and played me some. But he, you know, and like we were talking on Zoom, like you and I are now, and he would get his sort of CD, and he put it on the machine and play it. He played it over Zoom to me from his CD player.
Wow. These are songs that are unheard by anyone?
After about kind of 45 seconds, he'd take it off again.
Oh my, so wait, are these songs that no one else has heard? Maybe
I guess the whole of the New York music industry would have heard them, because Kenny was hawking them around and nobody was interested.
Oh, right.
But certainly, yeah, I guess in modern times, I think Kenny is probably still sitting on demos that he didn't even play to me. You know?
Yeah. Wow.
Dude, they sounded terrific. And I thought, wow, I would love to hear these, because you were asking me earlier what were my favorite Steely Dan albums. And I have to say that I really like a lot of the material that Kenny himself released as what was that album called? The Early Years, Becker and Fagen.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of these kind of bootleg compilations of.
There are hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And they were like kind of escaped zoo animals. You know, once they were wild, nobody could catch them, and so versions of these albums have been cloned and rearranged and re-released all in every country on earth. Nobody's made any money out of it except these pirates, you know.
Some of your favorite of those tracks? Do you have
I like things like Sun Mountain. I think it's a beautiful song.
That could take Midnight.